Blog Talk Radio.
We're all sick, tired, wasted.
Good evening, everybody. Bobby Rodrigo. I take liberty with my coffee. Coffee Party Radio, Tuesday night, January 13th. Going to get right at it. Of course, as usual, we always have a lot going on. As you know, we have a new Congress, and that's creating a lot of news. But that's not the biggest news that's been out there. Of course, we must send our condolences over to the cartoonist, the satirist in France that were killed by the criminal terrorists in France last week, and of course the solidarity that has come out about that. I have my own views on the Unity March and about liberty in France, but regardless, all life is precious, and certainly no one has the right to take another life ever, unless it's in self-defense or something in that regard. France is not the greatest country on free speech, I will add on that, on a side note. There are problems with the way that they've created laws that is restricting free speech, of course. One of the reasons why this is a great country is because we have a constitution in place that protects our natural-born free speech rights. So very important that that is remembered, but certainly there's the criminals that did the killings, and I say criminals because that's what they are to me. I'm not going to do the fear, terror, I don't care who they are. They committed a crime of murder. That's what they did on civilians, and they need to be punished accordingly. However, that is handed down. So I look forward to that happening, of course, along with anybody else that decides to behave that way. Getting right into current events. We've got a great show tonight. I got a really very important subject, Common Core. Very important subject. And I have a special guest on, Victoria Young, who I happen to have the pleasure of working with in the Coffee Party newsroom in trying to shine a light on the important issues that we have today in our society. And Victoria's going to be joining me here shortly. I'm going to go through some current events, but really looking forward to getting into this very important discussion. So a couple of things have happened, as always. Very important relative to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement that certainly does not benefit the people of this country. It certainly benefits the corporations, among other things. Saw today in an article that was released, actually yesterday, saw it in the CT Mirror. Dallara breaks with Obama, big CT firms on Pacific trade deal. So Representative Rosa Dallara is on a collision course with President Obama and some of Connecticut's largest companies over a proposed trade deal with 12 countries on the Pacific Rim from Chile to Japan. Very important. One of my issues has been throughout the TPP debate, of course, is that I don't see enough people coming out against it. Usually the argument is against fast track as opposed to slow track. Let's read it first before we approve it. It's bad. NAFTA was bad. All of that is bad. there's a long history of it. I don't need to get into details with doing current events. But I was very happy to see that DeLauro, Democrat from the 3rd District in Connecticut, has stepped out and took a stance and, of course, naturally, is making some of the corporations mad in the state of Connecticut, which is a home to many corporations, as you know, the insurance capital, et cetera. So I thought that was very good. So pay attention to that. And I will take that, and I'm going to try and put these various articles in the chat room. I haven't been very good at that lately, so I'm going to try and get better at it so people can follow along with these issues. Another big news, Ben Swan and Anti Media was reporting first. I also saw it on RT this afternoon that the two Albuquerque police officers were indicted for murder on killing the homeless man that was in the mountains that was not armed and that was filmed, and we all saw the film. Now, there's been some pushback, of course, and some conversations from the attorneys. As we know, these incidences are rare when there is an abuse of force and the accountability factor as far as being charged and brought before a jury of your peers. They may win the case. I'm not going to sit there and say that they're guilty or not guilty. I would love to be on that jury and see how they wouldn't be, but regardless, we are innocent until proven guilty, regardless of film or whatever, but I'm glad to see that they're going to be held accountable in front of the jury of their peers to determine on the basis of good evidence put before the court and the jury as to whether or not they're guilty. I thought that was great. Also, there's been some movement in the hemp world, federally, thankfully. A couple of U.S. senators want American farmers to be allowed to grow hemp. Now, this has been moving. Hemp is a big deal, especially for the economy. For those who don't know, please look into it. Please read up on hemp. Just take a little time and see what it's all about. Forget the recreational marijuana aspect of it, even the medical marijuana aspect. Two also very important things. Prohibition sucks. It's unconstitutional as far as I'm concerned. Recreational marijuana is safer than alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. Medical marijuana, that's a whole other story. We should have it everywhere. It should be accessible. Doctors should be able to prescribe it. If you've ever seen anybody on chemotherapy, and the nauseous alone, and then the way it helps people who have epilepsy, and all the other aspects that I am not even qualified to discuss medically, that marijuana has been proven to be helping on, or cannabinoid has been proven to be helpful on. But the hemp discussion is strictly economics. Hemp is probably the greatest agricultural plant that there is in the world. You can make more things out of it than you can anything else. We're talking 25,000 plus uses of a plant that can be used for food, for fuel, for textiles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on and on. And it also is a plant that doesn't need pesticides to grow. It is resistant to pests at all. So please take a look at hemp, and please demand that hemp be allowed to be grown in this country. It used to be grown just fine. It was actually mandated at one time during the World War II. It had to be grown to a certain extent by farmers in this country. Very, very important issue in our society. It certainly would create a tremendous amount of jobs in this country, in the agricultural and industrial, and it goes on. It, because of so many uses of the plant, it is extensive. OpenSecrets.org is reporting that one member of Congress, I saw this evening, one member of Congress equals 18 American households financially. Lawmakers' personal finances far from average. I'll just read this real quick. It would take the combined wealth of more than 18 American households to equal the value of a single federal lawmaker's household, the Center of Responsive Politics' latest analysis of congressional wealth finds. The median net worth of a member of Congress, the median net worth of a member of Congress was $1 million plus in 2013. a 2.5% increase from 2012, of course. Why would it stay the same? Compared with an average American household median net worth of $56,000. And we're talking households, so we're not even husband and wife income, you know. Once again, the majority of members of Congress are millionaires, 271 of the 533, boy, we're missing a couple, that's right, because we had, 271 of the 533 members currently in office are millionaires. That's such a middle class thing. I'm so happy. Check out opensecrets.org. It is definitely the best source, in my opinion, for information about where the money is. It kind of clears the air as to who's receiving money. Is my guy receiving money? You know, the future senator candidate, Derek Grayson, here in Georgia, loves to say my guy. I happen to love the conversation. And is your my guy doing this? Well, there's a lot of my guys on this list, Democrat, Republican, whatever. Just take a look at it, and it'll see. Kings, when it's good, Oklahoma braces for possible crude crash. Now, we know we're getting a lot of information now on these low gas prices, thankfully for the middle class. Of course, now we're hearing about bankruptcies, banks folding now. They're talking about it in North Dakota, South Dakota, all these places where the booms were. Oklahoma's talking about how the low prices of fuel, which, of course, has happened before. We've had low prices of fuel before. Might be causing a industry blowback. We need to pay attention to that, everybody, because, of course, we know how the rhetoric works. And there is being some conversation about raising taxes on gas to correct infrastructure, which is amazing to me because we already have taxes on gas that should be working for infrastructure. So where's the tax money going that already exists? Why do we have to raise it? We shouldn't raise it. Totally against the raising of it, et cetera. Moving on, as you know, that one of the things about the aspect of terrorism was Boko Haram, one of the horrors of the world, a group of thousands of radicals in Nigeria area. I believe the last count was somewhere in the neighborhood of 4,000 to 5,000. And mind you, I am not an expert on how many Boko Harams there are, so you know, please resist on say, oh no, it's 20,000 or 500. This is what I just read. Anyway, they killed 2,000 people last week in the Nigeria area, mostly women and children and civilians all. Horrible. And of course, our mainstream media is ignoring it. And our mainstream media is saying that other mainstream media is ignoring it. It kind of cracks me up. Democracy Now! Is covering it. The right-wing Blaze and Breitbart is covering it. RT is covering it. Anti-media is covering it. Mint Press is covering it. Pretty much CNN and Fox and MSNBC are kind of ignoring it. A little bit of conversation, a little bit of print. Not much going on there. Again, a horrible, horrible aspect of what's going on in the world. Some NYPD officers use chokeholds too quickly, Inspector General says. A review of recent times New York officers used chokeholds found that these officers quickly turned to the ban move and later faced inconsistent discipline, according to a report released by the Police Inspector General's office. I'll get that link into the chat room. Just hit the link to see. Also, I wanted to follow up and show what the report was as well. Also, very important. Oh, it says my message is too long. Okay. Well, I can't put that link in there. That's all right. We won't put that link in there then. Anyway, it is being reported in the media in the Northeast what the Inspector General did in that regard and finding this. The report is launched on the heels of the death of Eric Garner, of course. We all know Eric Garner was the chokehold recipient, the person who was being arrested for selling cigarettes, loose cigarettes, violation of selling cigarettes without a tax stamp, basically, and was put in a chokehold. He was unarmed. He was put in a chokehold, which, of course, is a banned hold. Chokehold is a banned hold. So the fact that police are using it regardless of how quick to ban hold. Chokeholds were banned in 1993, as a matter of fact, as this article goes to say, under then Commissioner Raymond Kelly, who at the time said his order was clarifying a rule from 1985. But after Garner's death, the Civilian Complaint Review Board, an independent agency that explores complaints against NYPD officers, conducted a review of more than 1,100 allegations of chokeholds and found that the number of chokeholds was increasing. So again, it's increasing. This article is in the Washington Post, by the way. It's increasing, but it's a ban hold. So it shouldn't be happening at all, period. I wanted to talk about this briefly because I wanted to let you know that, and you'll be seeing an announcement, if not next week, the week after, I'm going to be sitting down with a present New York Police Department captain, and we're going to talk about all of this, somebody who I know all my life, actually. And I talked to him about coming on the show, and he's happy to do it, and I'm happy to have him. So I want to stay on top of the police discussions both ways, of course. I saw a beautiful quote by Common the other day that really kind of puts the light on what's going on. Also, speaking of the NYPD, we all know that there was a slowdown of arrests, slowdown sanctions. NYPD orders cops to meet arrest summons quotas or lose vacation time. This is being reported by Ben Swan today. BenSwan.com. Federal judge says that former Virginia Governor McDonald must go to prison while his appeal pending. That's a happy thing. Let's kind of treat everybody fairly. If you go to trial and you lose and you're guilty and you get sentenced, you should go to jail. That's how it works for the poor. That's how it works for the middle class. It's supposed to work for anybody who gets convicted. We're going to do this the right way. We're supposed to do this the right way. Last thing I'm going to raise before I get into bringing in Victoria. Don't even know where to go with this. A number of agencies are reporting that in South Carolina, and I'm in Georgia, so it's just right up the street, lawmakers are proposing to require classes in school to have gun safety. It's called the Second Amendment Education Act in South Carolina. Now, we all know that I want a constitutional government. Okay, so regardless of how I feel about guns in our society, it's in the Constitution. We also have a constitutional protected right to defend ourselves with lethal force, Ninth Amendment, all kinds of aspects of that. But let's talk about how absurd this particular act is. First of all, one of my pet peeves with the Second Amendment argument coming from most people who argue the Second Amendment is that they absolutely know nothing about any other amendment to the Constitution or the Constitution at all. The only thing they care about is the Second Amendment. So if you're going to propose an act that requires that your kids learn about an amendment, why don't you just make it so they learn about all of them, because they do in civics class if we have a proper civics education. Give me a break. So leading up into my discussion today on Common Core and the education, I just wanted to point out this lunacy. I don't have any problem with gun safety. The NRA, before it became this ridiculous lobbying arm, corporate monster, all they were about, I mean, I'm 52 years old, I know the NRA very well, all they were about was gun safety. They wanted to make sure people were safe with their arms. And then, of course, they became this ridiculous corporate monster lobbying arm that just promotes, I don't know what they promote anymore. I don't even pay attention to them. I know that the majority of people that I've talked to within that agency, myself, along with a couple of other agencies, has no clue what even that there are any other amendments to the Constitution. I actually had one of the heads of one of the gun owners of America stand there and tell me that the NDAA needed to be voted on to fund our military, even though it's indefinite detention. This is a gentleman I was recruiting to speak at an event because I thought he knew the Constitution. Thankfully, I had Christopher Eddies to take his place. It's absurd. Then you have a situation where now you are over legislating the schools. Again, what is going on with this legislating the schools and the curriculum? We're going to get into a lot of that with Victoria, of course. So I'll use that as a segue, a little rant. I'll use that as a segue into tonight's show. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Victoria, can we load up here? See how it is? I'm not even ready. God, I'm telling you. Victoria Young is a veterinary practitioner by trade. She's worked in various areas in the educational field as well in her community. She's the author of Education's Missing Ingredient. And I want to bring her on right now. She's going to help us understand the realities and the truths behind what Common Core is all about. And let me just turn on her mic and welcome her to the show. Hello, Victoria. Welcome to I Take Liberty With My Coffee. How are you tonight?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you for having me, Bobby.
Certainly, certainly. I'm so glad to have you. It's such an important issue, as you know, way better than I do. I have found the discussion on Common Core to be almost distracting from its lack of information, I guess, from lack of accuracy, lack of facts. And as the coffee party, as we like to try and do, we like to try and be as factual as possible. And I know that you have a lot of time in this. So I wanted to get, first of all, tell our audience a little bit more about you. I mentioned you were one book. I know you have another. Tell us a little bit more about what you do and how you got started on this subject and some of the stuff that you've written.
Well, my history is probably kind of long because you mentioned I worked in the schools. That was anywhere from 11 years directly in classrooms to 20 years here in my community. But my work has been without pay. So technically I've been a volunteer all that time, from assisting teachers to sitting on science education committees. And the Common Core issue, you know, in all honesty, was one that I did not want to get involved with. I was asked, though, at one point if I would write an article, because I have written the book. My first book was, as it said, Education's Missing Ingredient. And from that point to now, what I did was a second edition of the same book, but it's called The Crucial Voice of the People, Past and Present. And that is what Education's Missing Ingredient is. So when you say you know more than I do, most of what I know, you know, I did research, a lot of research, but I also listened to a lot of people. And I have a lot of faith that if the people know the facts, they will guide us in the right direction. So I am really hoping to help clarify some things on Common Core from the research that I did.
Fantastic. You know, one of the things I want to get into just a little bit for background is, you know, there's always this, of course we are dominated in our society on partisan rhetoric, the right, left, whatever, Democrat, Republican, or now with sometimes you have a rise in other parties and stuff, and they tend to point fingers instead of actually look for solutions regardless of what, you know, I've had a view in my life where, you know, certainly it would be, to me, be irresponsible to think that one person knows all the answers or one party knows all the answers. There's got to be a way to work this out. And I think that Common Core has been a problem in that area. And it goes to the area of the Department of Education. And you mentioned something. When we first talked about being on the show, you mentioned something to me about the Department of Education that I'd like you to share with our audience as to what the real original intent of the Department of Education was. I'd like you to share that, please.
Sure. And, you know, and it goes back even further than the department. It goes way back when they were looking at, you know, curriculum, and really they were trying to remove illiteracy of all kinds. But as time went by, what they really found, you know, was the issue was unequal access to quality education, which, of course, you know, you put yourself back in time, we had segregated schools, you know, legally segregated schools. You know, not to mention that, you know, we had different facilities that kids were put in, whether they should have been there or not, and what kind of treatment they received. I mean, there were all kinds of reasons why it was recognized that the biggest issue the country should look at is ensuring equal access. And that is what the department, that was, you know, really their main function. But, you know, in addition, you know, they are also there to encourage public involvement. The only real accountability piece that was designated in law at the time that the department was established was to increase accountability of federal programs to the president, Congress, and the public. It wasn't the other way around. It never became an accountability mechanism for students, teachers, or schools until No Child Left Behind. So that was a huge overstep on the part of the federal government at that point.
Interesting. And so essentially, we know that Brown was in the 50s, of course, the great segregation case. And we know, essentially, what you're describing is civil rights.
Right.
Equal access is a civil right, you know, something that is protected by the Constitution and extremely important. And, of course, again, these things essentially happen in our lifetime and somehow have gotten mired in bureaucracy and argument. And the original intent seems to be the right way to go. So when you come forward and you look at, for example, you mentioned No Child Left Behind, which is the first change, I guess, major change on it. Do you see that? How do you see that happening? I mean, did you see it as some kind of equal access issue again, or what? How would you describe that?
Well, it was actually a progression of changes made to that law. For various political reasons. And then, you know, a lot of people point to A Nation at Risk in 1983. That was a Reagan administration commission report. But actually, it was a little bit after that the really big changes came in. And I would pinpoint it more to 1985 when the Carnegie Corporation, with the help of Mark Tucker, established organization that brought more business into education policy. And then we had this march forward for decades with really the National Governors Association, which is, even though it says national, it's not a government organization.
Right.
It's actually a private trade association. So we had national governors and business leaders, CEOs of major corporations, you know, pretty much take the lead on education policy. So it changed with the first Bush administration, with the Clinton administration, and then finally with No Child Left Behind under the second President Bush. So it was a progression of changes.
So before we go on with that, let's talk a little bit about who Tucker and Carnegie are. Just give us a little background on those two names, please.
Well, the Carnegie Corporation, of course, you know, during the early 1900s, you know, of course, they made a huge amount of money. I mean, they were, you know, fingers were pointed at them, you know, as far as calling them monopolies and that kind of thing. But they did go on, you know, as philanthropists and establish a lot of our libraries and our library system. I think that, you know,
sure,
they had, like many of these foundations in the beginning, had great goals in mind. As far as Mark Tucker goes, his evolution was that he then, you know, took over various and created various organizations that changed names over time. But his main thing all along had been that outcome-based education, in other words, standards-based, test-based, however you want to, performance-based, all of those names have changed over time, but it's all the same philosophy that No Child Left Behind is based on, that you can set standards, test for those standards, and that you're judging children's school and teachers by those, by the test scores. You know, that's the basic philosophy by which they thought they would improve schools. You know, in their summits, they had, you know, multiple national summits, And they really felt it was going to help, and they thought that was the way to go. But they've had a 30-year experiment. In addition,
right,
this country had experiment in the early 1900s and the 1930s, and thus far we've come to the same conclusion every time, and that is that standards-based education will narrow the curriculum to what is taught on the test. And the test,
right,
then becomes the guide for the curriculum. That's the opposite of what we really should be doing.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, it makes perfect sense, and that has been, of course, moving ahead. Such one of the great complaints that have been coming from both parents and teachers that are dealing with starting with No Child Left Behind, and as it escalated to Race to the Top, and now into the Common Core standard. Everybody is complaining about, well, all we're doing is testing. We're not teaching anything, and you can see it. You know, it's almost like it's creating a bubble. So starting the No Child Left Behind legislation and coming forward, give us a little background as to how you see that playing out up to from the No Child Left Behind to the Race to the Top aspect of it. Because you figure that's a good 15 years.
Yeah, that is a good point. Except there's one thing that occurred just prior to No Child Left Behind, and that is this group of CEOs and philanthropists and business leaders. They went together and decided, you know, it really was a good idea to start to train leaders. And so it was in 1999 that both Eli Broad, who was he was CEO of Sun America, which then incorporated into AIG. So the AIG, the too big to fail. So these are the exact same people. And then there's also a National Institute for School Leadership. So in 1999, they began training principals and superintendents. And that becomes important as the story unfolds. So No Child Left Behind comes into play, and it's really sold to the public under accountability, flexibility, and choice. And, you know, extremely good wording, you know, that really hits at what we thought
marketing.
We wanted. Right.
Marketing.
The marketing was
and just so we highlight what you're saying here, that is important, because even just recent discussions I've had in talking about, you know, it's important that educators educate. We're talking about AIG, which is the insurance bank, which is the underwriter of workman's comp in the world, essentially, which is, like you say, too big to fail, which is the $700 billion bailout that was done, and I believe that number is accurate, that was done because there was no way that we could allow that particular company to fail. And these are the people who are creating educational models and policy and schools and or training, educational training for people to educate our children. I got a problem with that connection, of course.
Well, I had a problem with that too. And that's why when I did finally get around to looking at Common Core, I really was outraged because you go forward from that, you know, from No Child Left Behind in 2001, it was passed, it went into place in 2002. At that same time, we also had the American Diploma Project, and that was an ACHIEVE, which ACHIEVE, Inc., that was all part of the National Education Summit. You know, it was an outcome. It was a group formed during that early time. So they put in the American Diploma Project, and that's when the public began to hear us talk about not just failed schools, but dropout factories. Again, the wording was really important, you know, that we understood that. So there was a lot of appeal. I'm not saying that people that were in favor of No Child Left Behind or any of these other things, how could they be so foolish? Well, when you read it, I mean, it was well done. So it went from there to actual data quality campaigns. We needed better data. And really, by 2007, Bill Gates was talking about national standards. He's quoted as talking about national standards. And again, in my first article I wrote, I said, you know, there's some value to thinking about that, but it is something I think we should have, you know, done out in the open. But by 2008, the group came out with a paper called Out of Many, One. Again, beautiful, love the title. But sure. Common Core standards, that terminology, Common Core standards, was used for the first time that I ever saw it in 2008.
Right.
So then,
I don't think I'd heard of it until 2009 myself, actually. I don't think I even heard it in 2008. It was as much research as I've done myself. And it's interesting.
Right.
That
so then,
I know
so
your
you
research
think
is
back,
good.
Though.
So I'm happy to know this.
So you go back in time. That is when we were hitting the Great Recession. And
right.
the American
yes.
Recovery Act was put in place then. The dollars were designated under the end of the Bush administration. And then it fell on Obama to actually execute the use of those dollars.
Right.
So that brings right. us up to 2009. And, you know, that is really where things started to roll forward with race to the
yeah.
top is actually then what came out of that.
Yep.
But what I did when I was asked to look at Common Core and feel if I was comfortable with the information, I was going to write an article. So I began by looking at the actual development team that is posted, you know, through the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers. And I just
right.
kind of casually, you know, was glancing through that. And there, you know, you always run across some familiar names. But I started looking
mm-hmm.
at particular people and who they had been associated with, you know, like what boards they had sat on, you know, advisory boards, that
sure.
kind of thing. And
where
I was
their
coming
training
up with,
came from, et cetera. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was coming up with Morgan Stanley, Smith Barney, Lehman Brothers, you know, and I'm starting to really wonder more and more. And then I found, you know, people that had association with security and energy information systems, Fortune 500 consultants. I mean, it just, you know, it kind of went on, and it didn't seem right. You know, you look back at what caused the problem and who ended up on the development team, you know, it just didn't
well, of course.
Seem right. So that's
again,
when I wrote my first article.
Educators. Yeah, we have no educators on that list at all. And,
well,
and
on this list there actually were. Again, this is off of their website, and it's a pretty full list. And there's a lot of dispute about who actually wrote it, how many people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know for sure David Coleman and Jason
right.
Zimba were two, and Susan. But those were, you know, those three for sure. But this is the official. Again, I'm taking these people's word for it. This is what they did not hide. But you have to really dig to see, you know, where these people came from. So I wrote my little article about Common Core.
This is the one that you put in the Federalist Papers site, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it
yes.
was the Federalist Papers that had asked if I was interested in writing it.
Yep.
And so, yeah.
You
and
are
I think
in Idaho.
Kind of, yeah, I am. And so, you know, I took a little different slant. I mean, I couldn't really write about everything that I saw, you know, in my travels there looking at the people. So I really just wrote a lot about, you know, federal control. And I just asked the question, you know, who, you know, does this seem right? Are we leaving ourselves vulnerable? Because we don't really have control over the information system. I mean, you know, again, we were being
right.
looked at. I mean, there were lots of things going on in the country at the time. I don't think anyone felt secure with any of their personal information and that kind of thing. So
right.
seeing the people that were on there, I was a little shook up that these were the people that were being charged with setting the standards for
right.
the whole education system at that point, because we were looking at 46 to 48 states that were involved.
Right.
So,
no, exactly. And we also, at the time, and still now, because you mentioned data and data, you know, data retrieval, not the right word, information gathering. Right.
Uh-huh.
So, and of course, we have the big NSA thing going on at the same time, all the surveillance that's going on, all the data collection. So it's immediately created this stigma of privacy, you know, violations. And of course, that also plays throughout Common Core. And, you know, this is the part where the rhetoric starts coming with, oh my God, you're a conspiracy theorist. Like,
right.
What are you talking about?
Right.
You know, it's not, yeah, it's nothing to do with it's what they're doing.
It's not like
theory,
really,
what they're doing.
Yeah. And you really couldn't, that's what I mean. I discovered all this stuff, but I really couldn't talk about it because at that point, any of us that were coming out against Common Core, one of the first things they were calling us was a conspiracy theorist.
Yes.
And
oh, absolutely.
I'm really not. I'm really not a conspiracy theorist. This is just what I happened to find. But, you know, I had some red flags that I tried to ignore because, my whole thing has been federal education law solutions. I really wasn't looking for problems. But one of the early red flags that I think people should have looked at was the PTA. Bill Gates had paid four states a pretty good chunk of money. I think it was $1 million anyway. I'm sure more has been given out since. But they put out a paper that is titled Educating and Training Parents to Support Education Reform. And it is Common Core State Standards Initiative. And this was put out in the fall of 2009. And, you know, I took offense just at the title. You're going to train parents?
Yeah, exactly. Same reaction that I had. Same reaction that so many other parents had. Yes. Absolutely. Well, it's an indoctrination wording, if you think about it. You know, it is an indoctrination type rhetoric. There's no question about it. You know, and when you are living in a society that is so divided by the rhetoric, by the elected officials, by media, and then you have this kind of wording come at it, you immediately get the, from one side, oh, you're a conspiracy, from the other side, oh, no, we're trying to create Nazi Germany or whatever, communist, whatever. But it is indoctrination language, and it's actually pretty arrogant to say you're going to have to train the parents to it's ridiculous.
Reform.
When did that happen? I mean, all of a sudden now we don't have the ability to be parents. We don't have the ability to – I'm a very educated person. My mother did not need to be indoctrinated to make me intelligent at all. All she had to do was sit down and play Scrabble with me and teach me how to write cursive before I went to first grade so I could get an A in first grade. I mean, come on. It's absurd. You know, it'd be literally that kind of – it's like they've taken the family unit out of the equation to some degree. I want to stop you right there. I have a caller I would like to ask a question, so I'm going to bring in a caller. And go from there. So area code 361, you're on the air. Where are you calling from? What's your name, please?
Hello. I'm in the chat room of Big Take for Triple X. I was just wondering. I would like to get into politics myself, but I want to know is the problem with the education system is how that some of it is. Perhaps it's based on an illusion that is mostly geared to those who are more affluent rather than for all. I just want to know since we're talking about the education and Common Core, I just want to know what is your opinion on that.
That's an excellent question, because one of the things that we've known forever about standardized tests is that the language used on those tests, they're designed by people that probably come from the middle class, and they probably are a particular area of the country, or now with Pearson doing most of it, they actually are located in England or someplace else or all over the world, is that the language used in the test will actually be a better indicator of your social economic status, you know, whether you're affluent or live in poverty, versus what you actually are capable of doing. And that's the biggest problem with using high-stakes standardized achievement tests to judge our system? So that's an excellent question. That goes to the very root of the problem with outcome-based education. Unless we all talk the same, unless we've all, you know, read the same books when we were little, we are going to use a little different wording depending on our different location in the country. We use different terminology, but they're gonna standardize the kids. I mean, that really is what they're out to do here. That's the only way that the system works. So, good question.
Great. Certainly. Thank you for the question. Fantastic. And if you need to ask another question later in the show, just hit one and it'll turn you off, and then hit one again and it'll turn you back on. And if you have any questions in the chat room, please let us know. So moving on now, and that is that really was a good question, because that is that is one of the big pet peeves of the parenting community, of you and I. You know, I have a 15-year-old who's a sophomore in high school, and he needs to learn the way he learns from the community he comes from. I mean, obviously he needs to know certain things. I mean, you need to know how to do 2 + 2. You need to know how to read and write, and you need to learn about civics. But how you're taught and in the community that is created, that was never anything wrong with that. We've been doing school forever in this world, and now it's almost like robot world. I mean, it really it's a Stepford approach. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Well, yeah, I'm not familiar with that term. What approach?
The Stepford Wives, the movie. The movie, oh. The Stepford Wives. Are you familiar with the movie, The Stepford Wives?
No.
Oh, okay. Sorry, well, you need to watch it. No, that's okay.
I obviously had my nose buried in too many books.
No, you gotta watch it, because you'll get it. As soon as you get to the first 20 minutes, you'll be like, oh yeah, I get it now. Basically, you know, you're talking about a robot society. It's amazing. I want to follow the money some more.
Okay.
I want to focus a little bit on the money some more. Because, when you talk about the corruption of our society, you have no better way to do it than how money is kind of, okay, well, we can make money off of that. And it goes right to the rhetoric, too, because in Georgia, for example, I am in a Republican-dominated state, and they went and brought up to take Common Core, to opt out. And the Chamber of Commerce and the Department of Defense came down here with all their money and ran it up the flagpole, and it was never opted out. So and then you go to New York, where the Republicans are saying that it is a progressive agenda, and it's because it's a Democratic state, we can't get rid of it, and that's bad. And then down here, it's the opposite, because, again, people aren't talking to each other about what's really going on, and it's the money that's causing this, without question.
It is. So
talk
when I did
bit
my
about,
original
like where that money is, where that money is coming from, and how they're making money off of it.
Right. And so what happened was then, okay, so when the Great Recession hit and they put in place the American Recovery Act, a group got together in Washington, D.C., and this is where it gets really murky about, you know, people when they get confused about, is it federal involvement, isn't it, what's the connection to Race to the Top? This group got together, and the paper that they put out was published by the Eli Broad Foundation, along with Bill Gates, and they called it Smart Options. And it's investing the recovery funds for student success together and decided how to spend our education recovery funds. They were supposed to have gone for, which is what we heard on the news, you know, they were going to go to help us states that had to cut education budgets so we didn't have to cut teachers and, you know, at regular operational funding. Instead, they set up this plan, and it's they that, you know, we really need, you know, people need to really look at. When I first glanced at the document and looked at the participants, there were so many people whose names I was familiar with, and some people will know, like Michelle Rhee, the Chancellor of Washington, D.C. at the time. So, you know, those names kind of stuck out. But there was one that I was not familiar with, and I put a question mark in it, and my mistake, I did not answer my own question at the time. So it's been a couple years coming back to it and looking at it, and it turned out the question mark I had was next to Alvarez and Marsal. They turned out to be noted for restructuring for companies including Enron and Lehman Brothers. So that got me looking a little closer at the rest of the people and organizations involved with that particular document. Because
Enron.
President
right.
Yeah. Because you have all of these organizations, and a lot of people have done a lot of research on it. You can find the, you know, documentation on the internet. But
sure.
You know, what became really interesting were the organizations that I did not know who they were, like KSA Plus Communications. They are to set education agenda in motion. And McKinsey and Company has, of course, been in education and an advisor for quite a while, but they drive adoption throughout an organization. These are their specialties. And then Alvarez and Marsal, they are known for accelerating results. These are the people in the room deciding how to spend our Recovery Act dollars. In addition to, you know, education council and education sector, which, you know, specialize in looking at the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act that we call No Child Left Behind. So it all kind of comes together with these big money organizations, you know, and the Broad Center having trained so many leaders, you know, in addition to the National Institute for School Leadership. Well, the Broad, I think I mentioned there were four, you know, think about
you
it, 43% of those large cities already have leadership trained by these people. They all have the same philosophy. And they even have manuals on how to close down our schools. So what they came up with, you know, is it ended up being the pillars of Race to the Top. Common Core
right.
standards, only they were told not to use the terminology Common Core. They were actually lobbied, the White House was lobbied to not use that terminology, to call it College
yeah,
and Career Ready Standards. The second thing was data collection. By this time, the data quality campaign that I mentioned earlier had ensured
yes.
that all of our states had longitudinal data systems in place. The third thing was the teachers. And this is where, you know, Michelle Rhee really came in. Her organization, Students First, was put in place a year after this Smart Options meeting. And, you know, she just really did a number on attacking teachers. And, I mean, again, you go back to the wording, you know, that she used. It made it sound like she was really in favor of supporting teachers.
Right.
But the reality was they were working on reducing barriers to teacher certification. So they were wanting to make it easier, and I didn't realize that was a problem. You know, the teachers have been going to colleges to learn for years. We talk about
right.
Finland, and they go 6 years. And now we're talking about reducing the barriers so that private teacher preparation can get teachers into schools. Now, I'm not going to pick on individual teachers. I mean, I always see exceptions to the rules. I mean, I look at myself and think, I would love, maybe, if there wasn't all of this going on, I probably would have enjoyed going back and becoming a teacher. But I wouldn't have wanted to go the full year. So was there any other option for me? You know, so again, I always see those kinds of things, and I'm not saying that all the teachers out there that came out of these programs are no good, because there are, you know, again, there's always exceptions. But it's the control that we've lost. And I think that if there's anything I would like the public to understand, it's that we've been 30 years on the same philosophy of education, and what we're seeing happening in our schools now is being blamed on the government when there's so much public involvement that, you know, it really needs to be sorted out. The truth needs to come out.
Well, it's certainly, I mean, just what we're talking about right now certainly has, basically we have the government being co-opted. You know, whoever let them through the door, and they have now, they've taken over the room. And this is, this goes right in step with everything that seems to be going on in our society relative to lobbying, relative to Citizens United, relative to ALEC, and I don't mean to bash one side because it's taxed, whatever. All this money that is taking control, people writing legislation, I don't care what company it's from, I don't care what it's for. We're electing officials who are just basically bodies that are standing there getting rich, essentially, getting taken care of, and they have these corporate models coming in. You know, if you look at even the Affordable Care Act, regardless of your position on healthcare in our society, the way it was done, you know, there's an argument that says that, well, it's a step closer to single payer. The way it was done was by mandating a marriage between society and corporations. It's absurd. If you're going to do it, do it. If you're do it the way it should be, where it, if you're going to take a stance, we'll go from the liberal side. If you're going to take a stance, and this is the way it should be, marrying us to corporations is not a liberal progressive position. It's also not a constitutional position. So it seems like this model is going on. And the from an education standpoint, it's been going on in our education system way longer because the Affordable Care Act is new to the problem. And they have
co-opted this has been going on for 3 decades.
It's absurd.
Yeah, and this,
it is
in that way, it's hard to explain, you know, even to use the word privatization. I mean, there are private services that schools have contracted for over time. I mean, we've always done that, but this is much, much different. This is private industry taking over education policy and training of our leaders and our teachers and our standards and our curriculum. And I will go out on a limb and say that, because we've heard over and over again it's just standards, but it's not just standards.
No, it's not.
It is actually
a
system.
And, you know, I had a discussion. It was a send off. It was a party, a libertarian party at a friend's house I actually interviewed her a couple of months ago. I call her Beth Liberty. She has a house and brings in a bunch of people, and they talk, and we talk politics and society and what's going on. And the a young lady there, Angela Bean, who's a teacher, who talked to me, and it was the first time I actually talked to somebody live. I've done it on the internet and even on radio shows about the longitudinal thing you just mentioned, and how the data is working, and it's mind-boggling how they're getting away with it, and how uneducated we continue to be, and how apathetic we continue to be in solving the problem. And this is, to me, and one of the reasons why I'm involved with Common Core is because I'm a parent, and we're supposed to be, you know, protective of our children,
right?
You know. And so we have to get past the rhetoric and get down to what the hell is going on in our society's education. One of the reasons why I talk about it a lot here in Georgia is because, as you know, Sonny Perdue is involved, and he was you know, one of our wonderful corrupt governors here. In Georgia, the Georgia politics are as bad as it gets when it comes to corruption.
Well, no, I'm in Idaho, so I've got some stories too.
Well, but all I can tell you is that I have a ranking that proves my point. You know, and I'm from New York, and I look at the politics up there, and I'm like, whatever happened to, you know, ethical politics? Because there was ethical politics in New York for a long time, and it amazes me. And of course, you're talking Democrat and Republican, and they're doing the exact same thing. If you look at the way that they are allowing corporations to run the show in both places, how can there be an ideological difference? And that's a different subject, but we're talking about protecting our children here.
Right.
And
I think we have that
opportunity the best chance
right
of
now,
being
though.
Great citizens, you know, great people. It's amazing to me.
Well, and I do think, though, that we can get a handle on it at this point. And it really, the No Child Left Behind Act, I mean, it's called ESEA, or Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It is going to be reauthorized. And that law is really crucial to how the country looks at education. I mean, we have just taken some missteps that I think can be corrected. I mean, we've ignored our own research. We've allowed, the governor's ignored our research. None of it is anything that we can't undo if we understand the mistakes we made.
Right, of course. I'm an optimist.
I'm still optimistic that we can undo
all
this.
I am too. I have to be. I mean, that's why we do what we do. You know, for all its negativity, activism is essentially optimism. You know, we are trying to change, and we hope we are, you know, we're trying to change. I always think the best of people and situations. It is a lot of like banging your head up against the wall. And, you know, I was thinking just yesterday, I was involved in a long discussion about policy. There was a discussion with the governor here, because legislation sessions have started in the country. And one of the pieces of legislation that's important here in Georgia to Georgians is medical marijuana, as it is in many places. And there's been some marvelous work done. James Bell, I've had him on the show, and Sharon Revert, and Libertarian Party people, and Democrats and Republicans. And there's been a really good group of people, and the Georgia Care Project, et cetera. And they presented the legislation they had. They have it sponsored, and Governor Deal goes and waters it down and tears it up, essentially. And there's been a big brouhaha about it. And it's unfortunate when these things happen, because the people want it. You know, it's the same thing that happened in Florida on the very same issue, actually. They didn't – I still want to ever understand why we need more than 60% to get a majority. But that's another story.
Well, in education in Idaho, we had these students' first laws, which I mentioned, you know, Michelle Reeve had been part of this. We had these laws. You could call them ALEC laws, or you could – you know, the American Legislative Exchange Commission model laws.
I mentioned that earlier.
Or you could call them first laws, you know, whatever you wanted to call them. But they were put into place, you know, quickly, of course, so nobody really knew the details very well. And then when it did come out in the open, the people did actually get them on the ballot and vote them down. But they're right back in the laws, and they are all connected to Common Core. And that's what I think people don't realize is that Common Core, when I said it wasn't just standards, I mean, it really is a package deal. This was how
it
was sold.
Go ahead, Victoria. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I was going
to
say, you know, that's how it was sold. And, you know, when you talk about the money, you know, the money is in curriculum materials, the testing companies, and of course, we don't know what they're doing, you know, what the plans are really for the data. Other than when this all started, it was expressed one way as being that they were looking at turning the education system more into a training place for employers. They thought the government would take over training employers. And I think that's what, you know, people really need to think about is that what our – I mean, I want my kids – you know, and my kids did come out of school, you know, prepared to go on and have jobs. And they should be. Everybody, just like you said before, should have those basic skills. We didn't need Common Core standards to do that. Actually, I think our
standards used to be higher
when we were kids.
Yeah.
You know, there's
been information about that. It's funny. I mentioned to you before when we were talking earlier this evening, there's a lady here very well-versed in Common Core who ran for state superintendent in Georgia, well-respected. And, and of course, she lost because the money wasn't with her because she was anti-Common Core. And you could see it coming out of the woodwork with the – you know, with the lobbying that was going on, where the money was going. And of course, she has the money out in full force
here in Idaho. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, sure. And so she has on her website, she had Mary Kay Bacala, her name is. I'll have to pull up the website and put it in a room. But on her website, she has, you know, she does a comparison, which I'm sure you've done. You do comparison where you have a standard in Common Core that says, okay, this has to happen in the second grade. Well, the curriculum that already existed here in Georgia was already happening in first grade, which means it's a better standard. I know California, that's a big deal there because California has such high education book stuff. Well, you know, there's a technical term, book stuff. You like that? You like that education term? But, you know, and of course, you know, I'm born and bred in New York. I know my school system was great back then. Now it's supposed to be like even to Common Core, but so what? It's mind boggling. I happened to, when I was doing some research into the show tonight, I came across an article that I put into the chat room that was written in Rockland County talking about the official tale of who developed the standards goes something like this. About 6 years ago, this is written last year, two not-for-profit public policy organizations, which you mentioned, of course, started a joint initiative to develop a set of nationwide educational standards for the purpose, by the end of high school, for successful college or workplace careers. The developers issued clear disclaimers of any federal input. Of course, well, they have to. You know, I mean, the other thing, too, and you can talk about this, please, is the way I explain Common Core to people is that the only reason why the federal government is involved is because they said to the states, in order for you to get our money for Race to the Top, your tests have to meet the same standard, as you described, of the Race to the Top requirements, and we'll give you the money. And that's the only involvement of the federal government in this particular aspect, as far as there's no policy, like you mentioned. They did not create the program. The only thing that they did is they told the states, well, you can have our money if your testing meets our standard. So, yeah, they're co-signing on it. Yeah, they're bribing it. Yeah, they're saying we support it. But they have nothing to do with it. You know,
what I think people should come to think about is, who do we trust? And those people that keep saying there was no federal involvement, well, a couple of them actually run, you know, Chris Minich and Dane Lynn. Those are the heads of those organizations that they say are responsible, the National Governors Association and the Council of Chief State School Officers.
Right.
There's an article, I think it was in the Huffington Post, where they're saying, you know, that they, lo and behold, had the backing of the federal government, as if they were surprised. These are the people that wrote the memorandum of agreement that I was so mad about, because they defined the role of the federal government for us. So if these two gentlemen were responsible for writing that, they just wrote the new federal education. You know, I mean, they basically told our federal government what to do. And I think that is outrageous. And then to turn around
you know,
and say, we don't know how they got involved.
Right. You know, it's interesting you mentioned the Huffington Post, because it's like you said, you mentioned when you were going through the history on how there were educational publishers involved. Well, the Mercedes Schneider, of the a teacher and a Huffington Post blogger, has uncovered Pearson Education, which you know about, created a charitable foundation and started donating money to the NGA and the CCSSO at precisely the same time that they started to develop the new standards. Recently, Pearson agreed to pay $7.7 million fine to New York State for illicitly using its charitable foundation to promote its financial interests relative to Common Core. Boom.
Right.
You know,
and
so
Pearson,
again,
you know, the smart options group that I went back on, I mean, they were, you know, I think the Huffington Post also wrote an article about the junkets. Or maybe it was the Washington
yes.
Post that did that one. The,
no,
the Pearson,
I believe it was Huffington, but I know the article that you're talking about. Yes, the junket. Oh, geez.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so it's the same thing we hear about with all the other policies, only, you know, to me, and maybe it's because I've been involved with schools, I mean, we're talking about the public education system, the education of children of this whole nation. And, you know, I just think that's wrong. And that's what I think people need to think about, especially those that are saying, you know, that they support Common Core. You know, I guess I'm asking them to think a little deeper. What do you think of the system it's setting up?
There's no question.
Yeah. Well, there seems
Let me ask you this, since we're now winding down mm-hmm. for the last 20 minutes of the show. Let's talk about solutions.
Okay.
Well, actually, before we do that, I have somebody who would like to ask a question. So let me bring in a caller.
Okay.
And have the question. Area code 412, what's your name and what's your question, please, and where are you calling from?
Hey, Bobby, it's Greg. How are you guys?
Greg Russick. Fantastic.
Yes.
How are you?
Interesting discussion. And, in fact, you just started to ask the question that I was going to ask the two of you, and that is, so what's your solution?
Greg, you got to be patient with me. You know I'm long-winded.
I think I was on hold for like 15 minutes, brother. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. So, yeah, I know there's a lot of confusion, I think, about what Common Core is. I don't pretend to have even the first real inkling about it. I talked to some relatives who are school teachers about it over the holidays. Candidly, I don't think they know what it is. But what I haven't heard yet tonight, and I'm really curious to know, is if the two of you were put in charge tomorrow, what would you do?
Victoria?
Well, I know what I would do.
That's right where I was going, Greg. Thank you.
I would.
You're welcome.
What I would do is I would look at the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. I would take us back to what our proper role of the federal government is, define better what the state government role is, and also the responsibility at the local level. And I think, you know, my solution comes from looking at how do we govern schools. Well, I think we should probably be governing it like our founding fathers envisioned the governing of our country. It is a balance of power, that we don't have too much power in any one particular point. And I think as we approach the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind, I think that's important for people to understand, because what they're saying at the federal level now is that we're going to put it on the states. But I have read Mark Tucker's report on accountability, and to put it in totally in the hands of the state is no better than putting it totally in the hands of the federal government. Which is no better than putting it totally in the hands of local, because historically we do know what local control, we know what its downfall is. We had segregated schools. I mean, we can't forget that. We have inequality in the country. So I would look closely, well, not just look closely at it. I would be working on the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, but at the same time come up with an accountability system that is reasonable, that shares that responsibility, that isn't totally test-based. So specifics, I could either tell you from top down or bottom up. Do you want specifics?
Yes, and Victoria, you sound like a very learned person. I've read your bio on Bobby's show. You seem to know quite a bit about this, but I will tell you, nothing you said anyone could disagree with, and yet I still don't know what the answer to the question is.
Okay, so when people want accountability, and we get this, those that support standards-based learning, which is what we have and what Common Core is. Common Core is just another set of standards in a standards-based system. But we can have what they call standards-aligned and that is different. That doesn't look at standards-based, is like an income-outcome research model. But standards-aligned is totally different. And you can assess students. And when you think back, teachers in classrooms, when you walked in, a lot of times they would put up a learning objective right up on the board. You knew what you were expected to learn. Teacher-designed assessments can be done right in the classroom to ensure that the student is learning the objective of the day or week or whatever.
And who gets to set that objective?
What's that?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I need to understand. Who set the objective?
Okay, so the objective can be set according to what the standards. Standards were only meant to be a guide. From
okay.
standards, if you go to Massachusetts' website, and I don't know if they still have it up anymore, but they take the standards and then they actually had frameworks that went from there, and they were different examples of things teachers could do in order to get across a particular learning objective.
I just want to make sure I'm following you. So who set the standards?
Okay, the way Massachusetts did it, when they actually did do it before they, and keep in mind, I'm going to use Massachusetts as an example because they actually were leading the country, but now they're falling backwards. But they were slapped with a lawsuit, and they had to adjust their system. And this is back in like 1994. And what they did was they got committees of experts and parents and community members and business people, and they had committees for each topic. So, you know, it was all the way from financial literacy, early childhood, everything. It's a very complicated process, and it does take some time. But once you do it, if you keep up with it, it's not that big a deal. But that's the process that it was state-led, yes.
So it was state-based, and somehow individuals from across some sort of a spectrum were able to volunteer, were nominated. I mean, I'm really trying to get to the root of this and understand if Massachusetts is going to create its own set of standards and Pennsylvania is going to create its own set of standards, how do you know if the students in Pennsylvania are learning more or less or what they need to learn than the students in Massachusetts?
Right.
And is that,
so
the model you're proposing?
Well, the model would actually be a combination of things. And this one thing has been proposed by multiple organizations, and that is that we go back to the standardized testing of the 1994 level, which was you basically did 4th, 8th, 12th grade. Because standardized tests are only a snapshot, standardized achievement tests. What Common Core promised or seemed to promise in the beginning was that they were going to do a different type of testing called performance testing. But in the reality, there's going to be one performance question. So anyway, if you look at, you can do multiple things to assess the students and the system. So that's why I asked, did you want to start at the bottom or at the top? Because it depends on what you're looking for. So at the bottom, the student, the teacher is responsible for the student learning. So you have that piece of the teacher-created assessments. Then you have standardized testing, 4th, 8th, and 12th. That you can use for comparison if you want to do that. It depends, again, on the test and what you're looking for. And then one of the things that probably has been promoted but not used nearly well enough is the accreditation process. A lot of those use quality review teams, and then they also teach schools to do continuous self-assessments. So you've got multiple, you hear people say multiple measures and you don't know what the heck they're talking about. That would be one way of looking at multiple measures. There's also multiple measures you can do, with the students themselves. But if you wanted to look at the system, that's one way. And then there is also the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And that is a randomized test, which does eliminate a lot of biases when you're looking at data. And that is what we use to assess actual achievement gaps, that inequality that everybody talks about, that you're hearing people right now, including Condoleezza Rice, saying that we have to have these tests every year. That's just not true. It just really is not true. She doesn't understand the test. So, anyway,
and
that's just a really, really quick overview of how you could take us from yearly standardized achievement tests that really, the achievement tests don't really tell us as much and aren't as accurate as we would like them to be. I mean, you can have a kid who's sick that afternoon and it's going to affect the test. Plus, they found that even the time of day the test is given affects the results.
Sure.
So it really doesn't,
sure.
It doesn't really. And then we talked about the language bias in the test. So there's lots of issues with the test. And for them to say they're going to make them better, again, that just has not proven true. When they did try to put together performance tests at a price that was affordable, they were sending those over to India to be checked. So I mean, right now the promises aren't there. And again, this is the exact same thing I sat through in 1999 when they first put a standards-based accountability system here in Idaho. The problems that you're seeing with Common Core are exactly what we were seeing in our schools then. Only it's a much different level now. I mean, the playing field since it's national, it's a bigger issue. So,
well, I appreciate the question and the answer, of course, and we're on our last leg down the last 9 minutes. And Victoria, if you got something to say to sum it up, go ahead. And
well,
of course, Greg, I appreciate you calling in as always. And
well,
you just did a good summary, I must say. Let me put it this way, Victoria, I appreciate you coming on, and I think that it would probably be a good idea, with the importance of this subject, especially with the other people that I know in this, and you know way more than I do, I have no doubt, that perhaps we dedicate some time to this issue this year and do it, you know, we can come on and do a show once a month about this very important issue and continue the education process, put together other people to come on and talk about it and continue to break this down and continue to take very good questions. So people can understand it better. So let's
right.
give that a shot.
Because the solutions, I mean, I really think that needs to be discussed sooner rather than later, because one of the reasons that we have gone through this is, you know, that they continue to say there is no alternative. But again,
right.
that really isn't the truth. The alternative has never been heard by the public. The moment in time when the public education system was actually nearing equal access was the period of time when the community education concept was the strongest. There was a community education
right.
movement.
Right.
And that in itself, to me, is the solution. So I would
well,
love
Victoria,
to come back
I really
and talk about
you.
That.
No, we are. I'm going to have you back. We're going to continue with this issue. This is very important. As I said, I know so many people who are, well, on all sides of the spectrum, but especially parents who are working
uh-huh.
on this subject, activists who want to know what's going on, who want to fix it, who don't agree with it, and who want to learn about it. And I think we should do that. I'm going to make a point of keeping this subject fresh, and we'll just keep coming at it. Why not? And I appreciate you coming on.
That'd be great.
Wonderful discussion. You know what you're talking
well,
about, which is always
me.
Nice. Absolutely. Yeah. Anytime. I'm going to take care of some business, and you have a very good – and stay warm out there in Idaho, and
okay.
I will talk to you soon. I'll see you in the coffee party
world. All right.
World.
Thank you, Bobby. Yep.
You're welcome, Victoria. So we're going to take care of some business. I want to let everybody know that the Coffee Party USA – we have a number of shows that are on the air. The next one this week will be Lunch with Loudon. She is on every Thursday at 12 Pacific time, 12 noon, and 3 Eastern time. Wonderful. Janine Loudon, she has some other co-hosts that are new that I'm learning about. She's also Debbie Lynn Molyneux stops in still, I believe, from time to time. The show is wonderful. She cares about her society. Big advocate for money in politics that's going on right now with all the marches that are going on in Washington. Pay attention. Janine is out there making sure that we are aware of what's going on, making sure that people know where to go, who to talk to at these marches, promoting the events so we can have a strong response to the money in politics issue. On Saturday, Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis comes on at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, Egberto is out there shining a light on many subjects that are important to our society. He writes a wonderful blog, EgbertoWillis.com. He also does other terrestrial radio as well in Houston on Monday nights that you can hear online as well. It's broadcast both ways, and you can always call in, and he's always talking about important subjects. I'll be back next week. I take liberty with my coffee. I plan on interviewing a New York City Police Department captain who I've known for 50 years, who has been living and working in the NYPD for last 20 plus years. Is going to talk about the subjects that have been going on up there, including the Eric Garner incident, the chokeholds, the relationship with the police and management, his support for Commissioner Bratton, and his support for Mayor de Blasio, and why he is and became a police officer. So we're looking forward to that, and I'm happy to be here talking to you guys, and I hope I'm bringing a little bit of light into your life onto what's going on in the world. Remember, the Constitution fixes a lot of it. Demand the protections of the Constitution from your elected officials. Tell them to follow the rule of law. Tell them to follow the oath of office that they took. And on that note, good night. Everybody be safe. Everybody have a good week.